Morning all. Now, I have a fairly big act to follow given what we've just seen and some of the other commentary and some of the other events this morning, which have been really good. But as has been mentioned, we're going through a Promise Keeper series. So we started with Abraham. Last week was Joseph. With Abraham, we saw that God had made a number of promises to Abraham, promises that are still being kept today. The generations that have come since then, the recipients of those promises being numbered more than the grains of sand. Joseph, we saw a man who consistently responded in faith, knowing that God would be faithful. He would keep his promises. So today we're looking at Moses and the Exodus, as we've just seen, and I will start by saying that that's too big a topic. It's huge. I've only got 30 minutes, I don't have 30 months, so it will be a very concise, specific look and focus really at the promises given to Moses personally. The entire Bible is an analogy of the Christian life, and probably none more so than the book of Exodus, given the journey of the Israelites, all of their complaints, whinging, all of the stuff that took place during that time. So I'd encourage you to read the entire thing, but as I said, I've got a short amount of time. So I want to start by asking, what is a promise? And this is something that I have literally made up, so I will kick off with that, hopefully. Can you go to the next slide, Kat? Sorry. Thank you. Promise. Valuable to the recipient. Promise is really only of value to the person it's being made to. And it's only really valuable if it's kept. If you don't keep your promise, faith, trust, hope, respect, all of these things shatter. Everything falls apart. So without someone keeping the promise, it's actually in the fulfillment of the promise that it actually has value. So by this simple made-up definition, I'd argue that God should only be trusted and believed in if he keeps his promises. And we know that's true, but again, that's what we're here to work through and to see that in practice and see what he has actually done. So I'm going to start with where I'm also going to end, and who would have known that there was going to be some Hebrew this morning? If you turn to your Bibles in Exodus chapter 3, you can keep your finger sort of in that place marker. It's sort of around chapter 3. We'll jump around a little bit, but chapter 3 verse 14 is where I'm going to start. Now, I will start by saying that I am reading from the New Living Translation version today for two reasons. It actually uses the name of God at various points, and not all of them do. And it's also relevant for me, as I'm a simple bloke, but I believe that Moses was a simple guy as well. So, Exodus 3:14, God replied to Moses. So this is at the point where he's at the burning bush, and Moses says, well, who am I going to say sent me? So he said, I am who I am. God replied to Moses, I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my eternal name, my name to remember for all generations. Yahweh. So this is the name that I want to use this morning, as opposed to God or Lord, as opposed to any other sort of generic term, not because I believe it to be magical, but because God gave it to us. And because in the book of Exodus, he keeps reminding Moses and the Israelites of his name. Now, a name in Hebrew terms is more than just the letters that make up the word and the label that we apply to somebody. It reflects the character, the person, the essence, the breath of the person itself. And I'm going to borrow from a phrase from a popular TV show by saying, God is telling us, remember my name. Remember my name. In Exodus 6, verse 2, he says, and God said to Moses, I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham and Isaac as El Shaddai, God Almighty. But I did not reveal my name, Yahweh, to them. And yet I reaffirmed my covenant with them. Under its terms, I promised to give them the land of Canaan where they were living as foreigners. So this cuts back to Abraham, to the journey that we've sort of gone on so far, the consistent promises of Yahweh to his people. But the other thing I'm going to comment about Yahweh, the term, the word, although I'm using it, is this is not, have no desire for this to become a theology in its own right. This is not what this is about. The way to think about it, for me, every time you encounter a new aspect of God's character, every time you discover something new, it's like adding a thread to his tapestry. Some of those threads are pure gold. They provide accent to the image of God. They are relevant. They are significant. But they all contribute to a much larger picture, a much bigger picture. Don't ever try and put God in a box. He should not be constrained to a single aspect of his character. So Yahweh is his name, but one of the many names used in the Bible to describe our God. So a gold thread to be sure, but one of many. Now I was going to just touch on very quickly, given, as I said, the size and scale of what this story is, cut to a bit of a summary view of what we're talking about here, the journey of Moses and the people of Israel. We've already gone through much of that, so I'm not going to repeat. That's been a better illustration than I could ever have come up with. But the point I will make is that Moses fled Egypt at 40 years old from killing the guard, escaped, got away, burning bush moment. And that's really where I'm going to sort of pick up from in a moment. Returning to Egypt to follow the request of that Yahweh had put to him, we saw probably the most amazing events from the Bible itself. It's probably, as a simple bloke, Moses, I'd say he had one of the most extraordinary lives of any of the biblical characters. When they left, after they departed, after you saw they went through the Red Sea, as I said before, there's a lot of whinging, a lot of complaining. Even after they left, they wanted to go back. This is the analogy of the Christian life. This is what I am certainly guilty of. But the journey of the Israelite nation, after they left, they went to the mountain. Moses got the Ten Commandments. They built a calf with the gold that they'd been given from the Egyptians. They mucked it all up. They stuffed it all up. They got to the front door, basically, of the promised land, and they sent spies in, and they said, yep, no, they're too big. We can't defeat them. They forgot to respond to the promises that God had given them, and they left. And they spent 40 years wandering around. So they made it much harder on themselves. They didn't step into the promises that God had actually given them. So, very concise summary. Let's jump to the burning bush moment in Moses' life in Exodus 3, verse 1. So if you go back a little bit in your Bibles, it says, one day Moses was tending to the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led the flock far into the wilderness and came to Sinai, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the middle of a bush, and Moses stared in amazement. He said, though the bush was engulfed in flames, it didn't burn up. He said, this is amazing. Remember, it's the NLT. Moses said to himself, why isn't that bush burning up? I must go and see it. When the Lord saw Moses coming to take a closer look, God called to him from the middle of the bush, saying, Moses, Moses. "Here I am," Moses replied. "Do not come any closer. Take off your sandals, for you're standing on holy ground. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob." And when Moses heard this, he covered his face because he was afraid to look at God, which is an interesting point given later he returns to this same place and sees God effectively on the same mountaintop. In verse 7, "Then the Lord told him, 'I have certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I have heard their cries of distress because of their harsh slave drivers. Yes, I am aware of their suffering.'" So now we come to, in verse 10, here's Moses' mission. "Now go, for I am sending you to Pharaoh. You must lead my people Israel out of Egypt." But Moses protested, "Who am I to appear before Pharaoh? Who am I to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt?" So, who am I? I, for one, am constantly doubtful of my ability, my capability, whether I should even be up here today in particular. One of the common prayers I pray begins with the words, "Heavenly Father, go before me. Go before me into whatever it is I can't deal with or cope with." And he does. And in this story, he prepared the promised land, but the people needed faith to enter it. And what did Yahweh say to Moses in verse 12? God answered, "I will be with you. And this is your sign, that I am the one who has sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God at this very mountain. I will be with you." It's a personal promise with a validation that Moses can cross-check in his life later on. Because if he makes it back to that mountain, yep, he would have seen the fulfillment of God's promises. So this was Yahweh's personal validation to Moses, his personal sign that he was speaking truth and that he would keep his promises. Now, fortunately from this point, Moses protests to Yahweh and says, "But the people will ask me, what is his name?" So he still needs further validation. So this is where Yahweh says, "This is my name, Yahweh." Move down onto verse 16. He says, "Now go and call together the elders of Israel and tell them," so this is go back into Egypt, find the elders, assemble them, tell them this message. "Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me and told me, 'I've been watching closely and I see how the Egyptians are treating you. I've promised to rescue you from your oppression in Egypt. I will lead you to a land flowing with milk and honey.'" So Yahweh promises to rescue them, and he says to Moses, "The elders of Israel will accept your message," in verse 18. But immediately after, in verse 19, he says, "But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand forces him. So I will raise my hand and strike the Egyptians, performing all kinds of miracles among them. Then, at last, he will let you go." If you read the book of Exodus, you hear consistently the message that Yahweh needed to show his power. It's a definitive message that reverberates through time. "Remember my name. Remember what I have done. Remember where you have come from." As I said before, in Hebrew, a name is more than a label. It has a meaning. It's the breath of a person. It is the character. It is their essence, their whole being. And in the plagues of Egypt, Yahweh is fighting a spiritual war with the plagues and signs that he displays in opposition to the gods of Egypt. In fact, one of the readings I read was talking about the gnats, the lice, that were one of the plagues. What that meant is that it made the priests unclean. So the priests in the land of Egypt were unclean. People were unclean. They couldn't actually go and worship their own gods. So it was more than just the physical effects against the people. It was against the spiritual beings, entities, the gods of that land that the Israelite nation were enslaved to. Remember his name, remember his fulfillment and what he says he will do. Now, in chapter 4, verse 10, we find Moses pleaded with Yahweh, "O Lord, I'm not very good with words. I never have been. I'm not now, even though you've spoken to me. I get tongue-tied, and my words get tangled." Now, remember, I'm reading from the New Living Translation here, and other translations I've read have, they say, "I have never been eloquent." Now, I'm sorry, if someone's not eloquent, they're not going to know to use the word eloquent. The nearest I can find in the Hebrew is that the word that's used here is literally basically saying, I can't arrange my words proper. That's what it means. So, although the New Living Translation sounds a little bit modern, I think it's got the vibe of what Moses was saying and the vibe of the issue that he felt in himself personally, his inadequacy. Now, remember, I'm focusing on the personal promises to Moses. So here we've got Moses saying, "Look, I'm not good enough. I can't do this." In verse 11, Yahweh asked Moses, "Who makes a person's mouth? Who decides whether people speak or do not speak, hear or do not hear, see or do not see? Is it not I, Yahweh? Now go, I will be with you." So he reiterates his message again and again and again. "I will be with you as you speak, and I will instruct you in what you say." But Moses again pleaded, "Yahweh, please send anyone else." Now at this point, Yahweh became angry with Moses, and he said, "Okay, take Aaron with you. Aaron will be your spokesperson." How many of us feel unworthy, not prepared, broken? Yahweh reminds Moses that he chose him knowing exactly who he was choosing. There was no doubt here. He says, "I know you can't speak proper, but I will give you the words." So why would Yahweh choose a man who didn't believe in himself? Because he needed a man who would believe in him. You see, I think we often think of Moses as the perfect choice for Yahweh to send back to Egypt because he had lived there. He'd grown up. He'd been in the courts of Pharaoh. He'd get through the front door. He'd know the politics. But the fact was, for the last 40 years, he'd been herding sheep. He wasn't court royalty. He was an adopted son, potentially with a speech impediment. So he didn't believe in himself, but God did. So, as the story continues, sure enough, Moses makes his way into Egypt. He's there. He goes to see Pharaoh, and things don't go well. Pharaoh says, "And who is Yahweh? Why should I listen to him and let Israel go? I don't know Yahweh, and I will not let Israel go." In fact, he goes on to say, "You're distracting them from their work. I'm going to make them work harder." So they still have to make the same amount of bricks, but I'm not going to give them straw. They have to go and get the straw as well as make the bricks. So the foremans, the Israelite foremans, come and say, "May the Lord judge and punish you for making a stink before Pharaoh and his officials. You put a sword in their hands and an excuse for them to kill us." So in chapter 5, verse 22, Moses went back to Yahweh and protested. He said, "Why have you brought all this trouble on your own people, Yahweh? Why did you send me?" Ever since I came to Pharaoh as your spokesman, he's been even more brutal to your people, and you have done nothing to rescue them. Then chapter 6, verse 1, Yahweh told Moses, "Now you will see what I'll do to Pharaoh." It's like saying, "Remember, I told you it was going to be difficult, but now you'll see." Now you'll see what I'll do to Pharaoh. When he feels the force of my strong hand, he will let the people go. In fact, he'll tell you to get out. And as like a final underline or full stop, God says to Moses, I am Yahweh. Now we'll jump ahead a little bit into chapter 6, verse 28. Yahweh spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt. He said to him, I am Yahweh. Again, it's just repeated consistently throughout. Tell Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, everything I'm telling you. But Moses argued with Yahweh, saying, I can't do it. I'm such a clumsy speaker. Why should Pharaoh listen to me? So time and again, Moses feels inadequate. He feels that he's not up to the task. He can't do it. All he sees is all of his failures, all of his problems. And then Yahweh says in chapter 7, verse 1, he said to Moses, pay close attention to this. So get this, Moses, like get this through your head. I will make you seem like God to Pharaoh. And your brother Aaron will be your prophet. So how would this have made Moses feel? Someone who didn't want to be there, struggled to speak, wanted Yahweh to find anyone else to do the task other than him. And yet this is Yahweh's response. Not like a God, but like God. Yahweh would make him seem like God. He would make him seem like someone that the Pharaoh might actually listen to, because the Pharaoh was used to dealing with gods. In fact, the first people Pharaoh dragged into the court when Moses started performing the signs in front of him, casting the staff down, turning into a snake, he brought out his magicians, his sorcerers. So he's used to seeing that. He was used to that. He was used to responding to gods. So magicians met these sort of signs were not new to him. But the interesting thing is that consistently you'll see as you go through the plagues that Pharaoh never turned to his own magicians to stop them, to reverse them. In every case, he had to go back to Moses to say, go tell Yahweh to stop it, turn it off, reverse it. And at one point, the magicians in the story, they said, this is the finger of God. They acknowledged that they were dealing with someone way above their pay grade. So, let's just jump ahead a little bit before I make my final point. Again, bearing in mind this is a fairly concise rundown. In Exodus 12, we come to the first Passover, so you can't go past this story without touching on this at the very least. Yahweh's final plague on the Egyptians, reminiscent of the start of Moses' life when his life was at risk. Pharaoh himself deciding to take the firstborn from the Israelite nation. But in this event, Yahweh institutes a reminder for the people of Israel so that they will never forget. Remember my name. So in Exodus 12:24, it says, remember these instructions are a permanent law that you and your descendants must observe forever. When you enter the land the Lord has promised to give you, you will continue to observe this ceremony. Then your children will ask, what does this ceremony mean? And you reply, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord. For he passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt. And though he struck the Egyptians, he spared our families. When Moses had finished speaking, all the people bowed down to the ground and worshipped. Yahweh is still saving his people today with the promise from his son. I will be with you. Remember my vague thoughts at the start around promises. So promises are only valuable to the recipient and only valuable if kept. Well, there's a third one I've added here, that they must be responded to. When Moses doubted his own ability or capability, he had to step into those experiences to see God's hand at work. To see God's fulfillment of the promise, he actually had to invest himself to see the outcome, to see the commitment, the faithfulness of God. The Israelite nation could have entered the promised land 40 years earlier than they did, but they turned away because they were afraid. If they had responded to Yahweh's promises, if they had acknowledged them, recognized them, and trusted in them in through faith, they would have been in the land much earlier. And the Passover is a way of always remembering the faithfulness of God. Remember that prayer I mentioned at the start, God, go before me. I've learnt through many mistakes that you have to turn up. So if you say, God, go before me into that circumstance, you have to step into it. You can't run away and not fulfill it. It's only by putting yourself into that position that you've asked God to be there, you turn up with him, that you will actually see the outcome, that you'll see him keep his promises, that he will be with us. So why did I make a point of mentioning his name? It's repeated so many times, as you've seen, like just the small few passages, like the consistent message, I am Yahweh, I am Yahweh. The word appears around 6,000-7,000 times in the Bible. It's almost as many times as there are promises to mankind. Next slide, if you don't mind. Thank you. Exodus 3:16. Tell them, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors. God said to Moses, I am Yahweh. Therefore say to the people of Israel, I am Yahweh. He said to him, I am Yahweh. Then announced to him, Pharaoh, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews. See, this wasn't just for Moses to the Israelite nation. This was telling the Egyptians. This is telling them, hey, there is someone higher. With every plague, Yahweh tells Moses to tell Pharaoh, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews. So you'll see that appear if you read through chapter by chapter. He's reiterating, it's the God of the Hebrews. It's not your God. It's not one of yours. The one true God, God above all gods. So he wasn't only telling Pharaoh, but reinforcing his name with Moses and the Israelite nation through all generations. Remember, this is my eternal name, my name to remember for all generations. But it's interesting that nobody actually is really clear on the pronunciation. It's one of these things that have been forgotten through time, partly due to the reluctance to actually utter it. There's a variety of pronunciations suggested. There's Yahweh, Jehovah, Jehovah, Yahweh. But Yahweh probably being the most accepted or the most common. It comes from the root Haya, Hey Yod Hey. And the root of that word means breath. One of the most interesting suggestions I came across over the years were around pronunciation of the name was from a guy who suggested that it should be an inhale and an exhale. So it's Yahweh. Breathe in, breathe out. I think it's more an interesting concept than a concrete historical fact, but I like it. I like the concept and the reminder that God gives us life. So the point I'm getting to, Kath, if you don't mind, point I'm getting to is the pictographic images that correspond with the more modern Hebrew characters from Yahweh, Yod, Hey, Vav, Hey. If you go to the next one, correspond with that message. Behold the nail-pierced hands. So, can Yahweh's promises be trusted? Passover and communion are a reminder to us of what he has done. And I don't think we need to look any further than his son. Thank you.